From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. Brooke Gladstone is out this week. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the president gave his long-awaited speech on Afghanistan.
I have determined that it is in our vital national interest to send an additional 30,000 U.S. troops to Afghanistan. After 18 months, our troops will begin to come home. These are the resources.
And so ends 3 months of closed-door deliberations, leaks, managed and unmanaged, sniping from Dick Cheney, and rampant speculation from pundits and analysts. But what about the American public? Were we swayed by the speech? Probably not. Research by political scientists has shown that presidential speeches seldom, if ever, influence popular opinion, at least in a long-term, meaningful way. Most people don't even watch presidential speeches, and those who do don't necessarily grasp the underlying policy complexities. And anyway, in the polarized environment of 21st century politics, audiences informed and uninformed are apt to believe what they wish to believe, no matter what the president says. But if speeches don't really matter, why are the media so obsessed with them? George Edwards III, a political scientist at Texas A&M, has a theory.
It's fodder for the media. It's what they have in front of them. And so, naturally, it becomes a focus for them to analyze. And over the next few days, there will be polls taken to see whether or not opinion changed on the president.
Well, what about presidents like FDR, whom we remember as having these fireside chats that had the entire nation in his thrall?
FDR was certainly a very able orator. But there's a couple of interesting things that people don't know. Despite American political folklore, lots of people didn't listen to the fireside chats. That's just a fact. Second, FDR had a terrible time moving the public. Think about the issue of getting the country ready for the biggest challenge of the 20th century, I suppose, World War II. And the president was very interested in this and worked on it constantly for years before our actual entry into the war. And he was frustrated at virtually every step of the way in getting the country armed. Indeed, as late as 1941, we almost disbanded the American Army, in effect, because we only passed a draft by one vote in the House of Representatives. I mean, that shows you the difficulty that the president had. And you can go to, you know, the great communicator Ronald Reagan. We all know that he was very interested in stopping communism in Central America and aiding the Contras. And if you look at his memoirs, he laments the fact that, as he said, he went time and time again to the American public, and the American public didn't respond. They didn't pay attention. They didn't even know where Nicaragua was.
Nicaragua, hell, Wisconsin. I think he bit off a little more than he could chew.
Well, it could well be.
In a perfect world for the president, he makes a speech and, you know, he improves in the polls in his approval ratings. And on top of that, he gets various Americans to notify their congressmen of their support for this or that position. Does that never happen?
It basically does not happen. I can think of one instance, and that is in 1981, Ronald Reagan gave a speech on behalf of his tax cut. And there were lots of people who communicated with Congress on behalf of the president, and that helped move Congress. That became part of the American political folklore, and that's what people tend to remember, and the fact that it hasn't happened since then is what they forget. And I might add that a policy which says, tell you what I'm going to do, I'm going to give you money if you support my policy, it's not necessarily the hardest case to make. And most of the cases the presidents have to make are much more difficult than that.
Okay. All right. Point taken. But I have to ask, if it's so clear that these speeches have little or no effect, tell me again why presidents bother making them to begin with?
Well, I think that presidents have a couple of incentives to make speeches, even if they're not very persuasive. And the first is usually to just maintain his own supporters. And that's very important. Maybe the first rule of politics is solidify the core. Another reason is that when you have a very important decision, there's an expectation that you take your case to the public. And if you're not doing that, it looks bad.
I think we'd like to cling to this sort of Frank Capra notion of a political world in which ideas as enunciated through sparkling oratory really make a difference? But if they don't, what does?
I think what does is what really ought to, and that is events, history, the real world. People respond to that. They may not have a handle on something as complex as the economy, but they know something about it. They have some sense of unemployment. They knew generally what was going on in Iraq for year after year when we weren't doing very well. That speaks very eloquently to people, and that has a big impact. The same thing that FDR faced in trying to get the public ready for World War II. There were very dramatic events abroad, and that's what they respond to, and that's what they ought to respond to.
Professor Edwards, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
George Edwards III is a distinguished professor of political science at Texas A&M. As the war stories columnist for Slate, it is Fred Kaplan's job to have opinions about the most intractable military issues of our day. For example, June 15th, quote, "After its fraudulent election, Obama should harden his stance with Iran." July 21st, "The remarkable vote to kill the F-22 and what it means for America's military future." September 17th, "Obama's smart decision to scuttle Bush's European missile defense plan." Kaplan doesn't typically shy from clear, direct language, and so we were surprised by his column from last Monday titled "Confessions of an Uncertain Columnist: My Mixed Feelings About the War in Afghanistan." After years of being mostly certain, Kaplan, who I should mention is Brooks' husband, admitted to readers that when it comes to Afghanistan, he just doesn't know. And he joins us once again. Hey, Fred, welcome back to the show.
Thanks.
You're not just some untrained journalistic kibitzer on these subjects. You have been, in your past, a defense policy analyst and are academically expert in these areas. What is it about the Afghanistan circumstance that is just so perplexing to you?
The ambivalence stems from this. On the one hand, if we withdrew from Afghanistan, it would be a disaster. And not just to Afghanistan and not just to Pakistan, but given the rhetorical support we've given to this war in the past, just to pull out now, I don't see why any other country would want or believe any promises or support from us in the future. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, we really haven't had much experience at fighting this kind of war. And in fact, nobody has had much experience at fighting this kind of war. I've talked with some of the more enthusiastic analysts and advocates of counterinsurgency strategy, and I've asked them, well, you know, name a couple of places where counterinsurgency strategies have really succeeded in less than a decade and that haven't involved a level of sheer brutality that would not be countenanced today. And they have a hard time answering that question.
How about this one? If we go in and do improve things in the next couple of years, is there any way to reasonably expect that we'll be able to keep that as the status quo, as opposed to having the Taliban eventually re-enter the scene and terrorize the country and its very, very fragile political infrastructure?
Exactly. What one good bit of news is that the people in charge of fighting this war, and I mean from the top down, do understand all the complexities. This is why, for example, General Petraeus has long talked about the need to turn some Taliban fighters, that a lot of the people who are allying themselves with the Taliban are in fact doing it for the money or out of tribal loyalties or because their cousin got blown up in an airstrike, and that some of these people can be reconciled to support our side in a war against the Taliban. There is a subtler understanding. That said, you know, just because our strategists are very smart, strategy is only part of winning a war. There's just a lot of uncertainties about whether we can do this at an acceptable cost and in an acceptable amount of time, and as you put it, to make the success endure.
Let's get back to the column writing part of all of this. As I picked up your column, I expected you to attack, let's just say, the counterinsurgency question about, you know, whether we can achieve the same kind of gains in Afghanistan that we did among the Sunnis in Iraq. Or maybe I expected you to look at the kind of Vietnamization of Afghan security apparatus and to ponder whether we could really train Afghan soldiers to continue the fight But instead, we got kind of an 800-word shrug.
More like 1,300-word.
Well, I got to say, Fred, it read like 800. Good for you.
Well, it's not so much a shrug. I mean, there's real anguish here, quite honestly, because, I mean, I do understand that people expect someone in my position to really come up with a position and to defend it. But, you know, I've written a lot of columns about Afghanistan which sort of begin, if President Obama wants to immerse himself more deeply into Afghanistan, then he should do the following things. But I had willfully evaded the question of whether he should put more troops in or whether putting more troops in is or is not a good idea. And, you know, I finally realized that I had to deal with this. You know, a couple of friends had said, you know, I've read your columns and I'm not quite sure where you come out on this. And, you know, I've said, well, that's a very astute observation because I'm not really sure myself.
You're kind of shamed into this mea uncertainta.
Well, I owed it to myself as well as to my readers to really think this through and see if I can come out one way or the other. And I found out, no, I'm just sort of unalterably ambivalent about the basic question.
All right, now maybe I was unfair in characterizing your 1,300-word piece as a shrug, but it was certainly ambivalent. And I've got to ask you whether you think you as a columnist can continue on this tack or whether you're going to have to seize on some of the particulars and be the Fred Kaplan that we know and love.
Well, look, this column dealt with the question, am I in favor of pulling out or going in deeper? That's it. Okay, the decision has now been made. We're going in deeper. So I'm dealing with that reality now, and my columns will be devoted to questions about, does what we're doing make sense? Does this make sense in terms of Obama's strategy? Does Obama's strategy make sense in terms of the evolving situation? So, no, I'm not going to be shedding tears and shrugging or pouring out my heart or anguishing in every column. But, you know, almost everybody in my position that I know is ambivalent about this, whether or not they admit it. And I guess I felt that I just sort of had to admit it.
Well, Fred, as always, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Fred Kaplan is the War Stories columnist for Slate Magazine. This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. This week, the Federal Trade Commission held a two-day workshop on the future of journalism. 2 weeks ago, American Public Media held a summit called The Future of News. A couple of weeks before that, Harvard University held a conference called The Future of News. And that same week, Yale University held a symposium called Saving the News. And believe me, I could go on. What we wondered was, is all this seminaring, conferring, and meeting actually accomplishing anything? When the killer asteroid is about to strike Earth, what is the point of a seminar? One person who's been to a lot of these conferences is Alan Mutter, a former newspaper editor who now teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. He says they're not all that helpful.
There's a remarkable amount of the same old yada yada at quite a number of these meetings.
And when you leave them, do you feel energized, inspired, hopeful, desperate? What?
Well, let's just say I'm at once deeply concerned and highly motivated to try to do better. You know, one of the problems with a lot of these meetings is that people keep falling back on trying to find solutions to save the old institutions that formerly supported journalism. And as everybody knows by now, the entire paradigm has shifted.
All right. So you've identified two elements that are missing from all of these or most of these conferences. One is young people.
I have, in fact, noted that the preponderance of attendees at the meetings are white men over the age of 45. Many of them, along with me, embrace the idea that we're in an era of change. But young people are creating blogs. They're starting new websites, new services. They're not waiting around for some grown-up to give them permission. They just go out and do it because the technology is so ubiquitous. If you want to become a web publisher or web broadcaster right now, you can be doing it instead of talking about it.
Another thing you've identified as conspicuous by its absence is some rigorous market research. You say that no other business on earth would face the situation newspapers are facing without understanding exactly what its audience is looking for.
Any other business that's going through any level of change or ferment would be doing an enormous amount of empirical, bottoms-up consumer research, try and understand what do consumers want, how do they want it, when do they want it, where do they want it, what color should it be. None of this is happening. It's just a number of people sitting around holding conferences, agonizing over the problem. And by the way, it's a big problem, and we ought to be agonizing over it and not doing the homework necessary to try to develop new solutions that will support journalism going forward into the future.
All right. I take your point about market research, but I put it to you that that is really irrelevant to the problem, that you can give the readers exactly what they're looking for, online or off, but it does you no good if the advertisers are fleeing in droves, which, of course, they are.
Yes. Advertising has been contracting in print, and also advertising online even has shrunk lately. But when I talk about market research, I'm talking not simply about how to deliver news stories. I'm talking about creating products that consumers will pay for. People are paying oftentimes up to $20 for apps on the iPhone. I should think that the New York Times app on the iPhone ought to be something that people pay for, and I think they would pay for it if that was the only way to get it. Further, I think there are a number of interactive advertising products that could have been, should have been, and ought to have been invented by publishers over the years. The market for employment advertising was theirs to lose. For real estate advertising and auto advertising was theirs to lose. And they've gone off and lost it for the most part.
Oh, wait, wait, let me interrupt you right here. I think I hear a jingle coming on.
Present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
I had no idea where I was. I was building up a head of steam till you stopped me.
I know. I'm sorry.
I also believe that with the overwhelming amount of information, the chore of trying to manage all these various flows of information becomes truly overwhelming if you want to be a well-informed individual. So I think that new products leveraging technology as well as human beings, good old editors, I think those kinds of products people would pay for, and they would value them, and they would subscribe to them once and keep them on and on into the future.
Well, it sounds like a pretty good list of possibilities. What about a conference on that?
Well, we did have one conference that we organized at Berkeley just a few weeks ago, and the mantra of that conference was no kvetching. We didn't want anybody there talking about how bad things were or how good they used to be. We wanted to look forward. And so we talked about things like how to manage databases and the semantic web and how to leverage the social behavior of the web to propagate content and advertising. I think I can safely say that almost everybody who left refreshed and left optimistic that there were lots of things that could be done. But first, you have to get out of the box of lamenting that which is lost and embrace the challenges and the uncertainty of the future.
Alan Mutter is a former editor at the Chicago Sun-Times. He now blogs at newsasaur.blogspot.com. Alan, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
As many a conference agenda has hashed out, lost print circulation and classified ad revenue have undermined the old business model. But as the business heads online, arises another big problem, the outright theft of content, what the industry sometimes calls reuse. In other words, an article may originate with the New York Times or the Associated Press, but it soon makes its way in whole or in part onto other websites that then sell advertising against it. In the copy and paste world of the internet, stealing is a simple mouse click away, and newspaper articles are easy pickings. A group called the Fair Syndication Consortium has, for the first time, put out hard numbers identifying just how widespread the problem is. Joining us to discuss the study is Mark Fitzgerald, editor-at-large for Editor and Publisher magazine. Mark, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
First of all, Fair Syndication Consortium, who dat?
Well, that's a ton of people. It's got about 1,100 newspaper members, and they're trying to get a solution to exactly that theft problem. They've got an idea that they can find out who's reusing newspaper content and then get them to partner with the newspaper and pay some money back.
So what are the numbers?
It's pretty astounding. They looked at only 157 newspapers. Now, that's barely a tenth of the daily newspapers in the United States. And they found that more than 110,000 articles were swiped from them by 75,000 websites that were not given permission to use these articles. So they're just grabbing this stuff.
That's a lot of loot. How long did it take for them to, you know, to back up the trucks to the loading dock? Did this take years to accumulate this number of story? Months? What?
All of 30 days, from the 15th of October to the 15th of November.
Yikes. What constitutes swiping? Is it a simple link and then maybe a headline to describe the piece that, you know, once you click on the link, you go into the particular newspaper's website? Or do you have to actually borrow much more text to be considered a thief?
Yeah, newspapers don't mind having links like that. Newspapers in general like things like Google News, which is just a headline and a link, and it brings you into their site. Now, what they're talking about is actually taking more than 80% of the words, the entire article, and just posting it up on their own site. And not so coincidentally, there's a little ad next to it, the revenue from which newspapers do not get.
You've seen this with your own work in editor and publisher, you know, which ain't the New York Times.
No, exactly.
But has an audience.
Exactly. You know, I do not write deathless journalism, but last night I decided to take a look at just one story. Now, this is from August 21st, and the headline was, Moody's retains Gannett's investment grade rating, but warns of possible downgrade. Now, I'm sure you're still buzzing about that story.
Oh, yeah. I think it's just below Tiger Woods on the, the most Google searches.
And yet, that was taken by 500 sites. 500 sites, including sites in Polish, including something called the Institute for Allergies, Asthma, and Immunology. Regular business type of sites. There are places on the web that want to be, in effect, virtual newspapers that have the Tiger Woods story and my boring stuff. And it's just, why don't you come here rather than go to the New York Times or the Chicago Tribune or the Sun Times, for instance?
Okay. So we've established the problem. It's probably larger in scale than anyone imagined. Now what?
And that is the problem. Now what?
Oh, you know what? Hold it. Let me just stop you there. Hit the jingle.
Present and future business models for monetizing the newspaper industry.
Okay, that's better. Now, solutions?
Exactly the problem. There are maybe too many solutions. There are maybe too many models out there at this point. You can have people pay a little bit for each little article that they have. You could have something that's like a newspaper subscription where they pay a certain amount of money for a month's worth of access to everything. You can wall some of your news articles off and let people see some stuff for free. There are a ton of solutions out there. The only thing that we really know is that something will be done and will be done rather quickly. Rupert Murdoch is the sort of lead pioneer on this, and he wants to wall off the news articles from the New York Post and the Times of London and the other newspapers and broadcast news organizations that he has. And I think that what's happening is that everybody is like, after you, Rupert, be our guest. You know, you be the penguin off the ice cliff first.
So paywalls are swell, but let's just say your whole business is built around stolen content. What's to stop you, let's say you're the Huffington Post, for argument's sake, just subscribing to the New York Times, one subscription, and then, you know, getting inside the paywall and doing what you've always done, which is to lift large sections of content and put them on your website with a link and collect the ad revenue?
Aha. Nothing. Nothing stops you right now. What many newspapers are looking for is a change in copyright law that would increase the penalties of the so-called fair use for news. As it stands now, you really can take most of, you know, copyrighted news material and just disseminate it any way you want because of a change that Congress made in the copyright law about 20 years ago. If you would just go back to the copyright law that we had before the 1980s, some people argue, you would be able to threaten them with a lawsuit. You wouldn't really have to probably litigate much because the mere threat would be enough to have them either partner with you or not, or just stop that theft.
Well, Mark, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Bob.
Mark Fitzgerald is editor-at-large for Editor and Publisher. For 25 years, Mike Penner was a sports writer at the Los Angeles Times, covering the wide world of athletics as a reporter, columnist, and essayist. Press boxes, locker rooms, All in all, a macho environment, if ever there was one. And so it was perhaps especially shocking to readers when, in 2007, Penner wrote that he would return after a vacation with a new byline, Christine Daniels. In what was to be Penner's last column as a man, he wrote,
"I am a transsexual sports writer. It has taken more than 40 years, a million tears, and hundreds of hours of soul-wrenching therapy for me to work up the courage to type these words."
Penner, by then Daniels, had become most likely the world's first transsexual sports writer. That audio is from a 2007 interview with the erstwhile NPR program Day to Day, in which Daniels described the experience of changing gender in a very public way.
146, the first email from a reader came, and it was slugged. The subject line was, "You go, girl." By about 6 or 7 L.A. time, I was getting one email a minute. By 5 or 6 o'clock that evening, I had 538 emails, and two were negative. And I thought this could have been the worst day of my life, worst day of my career. I didn't even know if I was going to get through it. And as it turned out, it was one of the best days I've ever had.
The introduction of his female self column won the sports writer widespread plaudits for courage and honesty. And for the next year, Christine Daniels took over Mike Penner's beats. But then, about a year ago, Mike Penner returned. And last week, Mike Penner died, an apparent suicide at age 52. Mike James was Penner's colleague for more than 20 years, and he joins us now. Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
Tell me about Mike Penner, the sports writer, before the transformation.
Well, Mike was an immensely talented writer. He was very skilled at dissecting a good deal of information and putting it in a way that would be entertaining. He would skewer people when necessary or deal with sensitive pieces with a very considerate touch. He loved the absurd elements in sports, and there are a lot of them. And Mike liked getting into that. He covered everything from baseball to the Olympics to football. As a columnist, he covered the LA Rams, the Anaheim Angels for a long time, and did it with great skill. He was an extraordinary talent.
When Mike Penner became Christine Daniels, she did not spend a whole lot of time in locker rooms or press boxes or bars with the sports writers she had known when she was Mike Penner.
Mike had, for an extended period of time before the transformation, become an essayist and wasn't out in the field as much. He was taking information either from inside the office or working from home, as many of our writers do. Mike hadn't actually covered a team beat for quite a while before the transformation, and that continued.
So if there were to be backlash to this very public voyage, he was, or she was, at least spared it in the most public places.
Yes, I'd say that'd be true. There was a lot of support here for Mike and for Christine because he developed so many relationships with so many people, and virtually all of those were, I wouldn't say unaffected, but all of those people retained the same fondness for the person.
When Mike Penner introduced himself as Christine, he did so in the most public way, in what was to have been his final column as Mike Penner. When he reemerged as Mike Penner after a year as Christine, no such column. Do you know why?
That was his choice. And because it was such an intensely personal matter, the entire process, that was his request, and we honored that because we thought it was important to grant him that. So we went along with it.
Now, Mike, this story obviously has an appeal to morbid curiosity. But is there something larger that we have learned?
I think that I'm not sure, Bob, that I'm really capable of answering that one. I haven't got much beyond just thinking about Mike and looking back on his life and the experiences that I had with him over 25 or so years to look much beyond that. But I'm sort of choosing right now to think about his overall life as a journalist and the incredible body of work that he produced. I mean, I've printed out stories just to look at them, and it's kind of an awe-inspiring collection of work. He was prolific and incredibly talented.
How would you like Mike Penner to be remembered?
That's actually easy. I'd like Mike Penner to be remembered as a gentle, kind, thoughtful, incredibly imaginative person who was capable of taking any situation in the sports world, and I'll just say the sports world because that was the venue in which he worked, but I think he could have done it in any field, and put on paper an incredibly readable, fast-paced account of what had just happened, and always teach you something about what had just happened, even if you had just seen it. You would learn something by reading what Mike wrote about it.
Do you fear that Mike will be remembered for his work of body as opposed to his body of work?
Of course, you've got to fear that. But I think that if you step back and look at what's there for the duration, that the body of work is really what defines him.
All right, Mike. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Mike James is a sports editor for the Los Angeles Times. This is Christine Daniels again in 2007.
I feel like I stepped up, and I've likened it to having an economy ticket and suddenly trading in all my frequent flyer miles, and now I'm in first class. I got more room to stretch.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for On the Media comes from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, supporting the performing arts, environmental conservation, medical research, and the prevention of child abuse. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the Wallace Foundation, a source of ideas for expanding learning opportunities beyond the school day, at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. The Liberal Democratic Party has ruled Japan for 53 of the past 54 years. But in August, the perennial opposition party, the Democratic Party, finally won control of the government in a landslide victory. It campaigned with the promise of cleaning up the corruption and coziness between government, corporations, and the media. That coziness is embodied by the press clubs of Japan. They call them Keisha clubs. There are thousands of them located inside of every office you can imagine. Government agencies, political parties, businesses, even consumer groups. Outsiders are barred and membership is exclusive, open only to journalists from major newspapers and broadcast networks. Already, the newly elected Democratic Party has tried to open up some of the government press clubs to all reporters. But the ruling party is finding that job not so easy, because the rules of the club are written by the club members themselves, not the government. So for now, the Keisha club system remains more or less intact. Last year, we sent OTM producer Mark Phillips to Tokyo to examine this system, and this is what he found.
The media in Japan has its share of paradoxes. For instance, circulation numbers are huge here. In fact, Japan's top five papers are in the top 10 worldwide. And the most read paper, the Yomiuri Shimbun, has the world's biggest circulation, almost twice USA Today, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times combined. The paradox? The Japanese, who read more papers per capita than anyone, except Norwegians, almost always describe their newspapers as boring.
They go, Prime Minister Aso woke up at X hour in the morning. He took a walk for 4 minutes and 30 seconds. He's headed for the bar at the Imperial Hotel at night. He eats a hamburger, etc., etc.
Takashi Uesugi, a freelance journalist in Tokyo, is author of the book The Collapse of Journalism, which blasts Japan's Keisha clubs. And he's in a position to know. He started his career as a reporter working inside the Keisha club system, but then left to work in the government.
When I was on the politician's side, I thought, wow, what a convenient system. Oh, I utilize it every day.
Uesugi was a political aide in the Liberal Democratic Party, the conservative party that's held uninterrupted power here since 1955, minus a few months in 1993. When Uesugi needed to release bad news, he spoke only to the press inside the party's Keisha Club, where a club dynamic ensures one reporter doesn't print the story ahead of the pack.
I like the convoy system. No one should stand out. If you are the only one who gets the scoop, you are given the cold shoulder. If you are the only one who doesn't write it, then you are condemned by your company.
To safeguard against accidental initiative, members of a Keisha club, reporters from different papers, share notes in a practice called memo matching. it often results in newspapers printing identical stories. One night I saw three evening papers lead with an identical headline. In fact, two out of three even had the same sub-headline. The fear of being last, or first, ensures that the press club reporters release information in lockstep. So Uesugi sneaks into the Liberal Democratic Party's Keisha Club, as well as the Prime Minister's, posing as a secretary.
When they find me, they throw me out. One time, for example, the manager of the Keisha Club approached me and said, "Why are you here? Who gave you permission?" I told him, "Oh, I got lost and I just found myself in here." And they said, "Don't give us that crap. Get the hell out. If we see you next time, we'll report you to the police for trespassing." Well, I still sneak in there anyway. There are a number of ways, but I cannot get into that.
It sounded fun, so I snuck into a private Keisha club myself. I promised my guide not to say which one, but like all such clubs, it was located inside the agency the reporters were supposed to be covering, with separate sections for print and broadcast. It's reminiscent of a summer camp or a college dorm with bunk beds that double as desks, run-down furniture with cigarette burns, and baseball trophies on top of file cabinets. In one corner, there are four TV screens always on. Outside the curtain is a common area with vending machines and beaten-up coffee tables. With morning and evening editions to write for, many reporters spend days on end inside the club. And the agency's PR room is just a few doors down, which, critics argue, creates a too cozy environment.
It is almost equivalent to a bunch of male geisha.
Yata Suzuki was a Keisha Club member when he was a newspaper reporter. Now he writes for the weekly magazines.
The best-behaved reporters at the Keisha Club are the first to get information. All they can do is hang out with the authority, drinking sake and having fun, trying to please them.
But the bond between reporter and official runs deeper than the booze, the cigarette breaks, and the office space they share. Their whole careers are intertwined. Takashi Uesugi.
Strangely enough, if a reporter started out covering Mr. Aso when he was a foreign minister, basically the same reporter follows Mr. Aso for the rest of his life. As a pet politician rises up the food chain, so does the reporter who follows him.
In this setup, reporters play the role of protector, not investigator. Again, Takashi Uesugi.
If the reporter gets some information about this politician's rival scheming or something, he would warn him. You see, if your politician has a big downfall caused by a scandal, you have a downfall too. Maybe getting assigned to some remote area. Then you can't write anything.
Keisha Club reporters also give their politicians a heads up on what questions will be asked at the press conferences. Sometimes the answers are even typed up and given to reporters in advance, making the actual event a mere formality. I got a taste of that at the Japanese Newspaper Association, which oversees and makes guidelines for the Keisha Clubs. I submitted questions in advance, and when I arrived, seven stern-looking men were waiting for me at a long table. With harsh lights and sweaty foreheads, it felt like an interrogation scene from the movies. One of the men reached across the table, handed me a printout of the answers, and started reading them.
The answer is, see page 1, second paragraph. The answer I'm about to read is written here. This is a guideline.
Shinsuke Sano, managing editor at one of Japan's largest newspapers, and chairman of the Subcommittee on the Problems of the Keisha Clubs, is reading excerpts of the association's official guidelines in response to my question, why do Keisha Clubs exist?
Public institutions in Japan are rather reluctant to disclose information. The history of the Keisha Club is that it has functioned as a collective team to pressure them to disclose information to the journalists. The Keisha Club has been active for over a century, representing Japanese citizens who are entitled to obtain information. That's the answer to the first question.
But what about freelance reporters' complaints that journalists who aren't members of Keisha clubs get shut out of press conferences?
There are occasions where we are the one to host a press conference, and on many of those occasions we allow freelance journalists and magazine reporters, as long as they agree to follow our rules.
And can I ask you what some of those rules are?
Shinsuke Sano paused for over a minute as the various representatives shuffled through their papers to find an official response to my ad-libbed question.
For example, they have to be magazine reporters or media reporters with long-standing careers. Other criteria, they have to have the common interest of fair reporting to be able to cooperate with the management of the club and for them to comply with our high standards for media ethics.
Then Sano handed me the Canon of Journalism Ethics and stipulated that freelancers must prove their allegiance to its principles through their actions, an abstract requirement that effectively shuts out freelance and magazine writers. But Sano says there's nothing stopping those reporters from approaching officials directly.
If you need to speak privately to a certain individual, it would be through that individual's secretary or office, I suppose. The Keisha Club would have nothing to do with it.
That's exactly what Takashi Uesugi tried to do in 1999, when then-Prime Minister Obuchi actually said yes to his interview request.
While the office of Mr. Obuchi okayed the interview, the office had to submit the Prime Minister's daily schedule to the Cabinet Keisha Club. According to the Keisha Club, it would be a violation of the rules for me to do a one-on-one interview with Prime Minister Obuchi. I said, Prime Minister Obuchi granted me the interview himself. Why shouldn't I be able to interview him? The Keisha Club replied, rules are rules. If you want an interview, you need to belong to our organization, and only then can you reapply for a one-on-one interview. And while this was all going on, Mr. Obuchi had a stroke, got hospitalized, and passed away. And that was that.
Little has changed since. Outsiders can't get in, and insiders can't get the word out because of the club rules, including blackboard agreements, lists of stories they can't write. Shinsuke Sano at the Newspaper Association.
We don't actually have a blackboard agreement. We don't have a blackboard. How it works is that, for example, if there is a kidnapping case, in order not to interfere with the ongoing investigation, we discuss and make an agreement on keeping some information. Otherwise, as a rule, we try not to have agreements as much as possible.
Here's today's blackboard agreement. Let me show it to you.
Author and freelancer Takashi Uesugi says there are blackboard agreements handed out every day at various Keisha clubs, and he opened up his laptop to show me a leaked copy of that day's blackboard list from the Prime Minister's Club. Among various items not to be written was a bona fide blockbuster.
This was handed to me by a private secretary of Prime Minister Aso. Japan considers lending $100 billion to financial market. This is considered a scoop. However, if you went off by yourself and wrote this, you and your news organization will be banned.
And so the bailout scoop went unpublished for a couple days until the time when the blackboard agreement stipulated it could be published. Yet scoops and scandals still break in the media here. How they do it is another great paradox of Japanese journalism. Keisha Club reporters leak the stories they can't print to rival reporters at the weekly magazines. Writer Yata Suzuki is a frequent recipient.
In that context, the weekly magazines and the press club have a codependent relationship. If the stories become public knowledge by being printed in the magazines, they can then write about them in the papers.
Sometimes the Keisha Club reporters will even write the stories themselves for the weeklies. Of course, they use a pen name so as not to get fired, and because most of the weeklies are... Well, I went to a newsstand with former Tokyo crime reporter Jake Adelstein.
What are the headlines?
Some of these headlines are so offensive I can't even translate them for you.
What?
They're talking about somebody's Mongol-shaped breast.
Adelstein's assistant had to jump in to clarify.
A girl who's 15 years younger than he is with a breast that has a... It's so big, it's like mango.
Well stated. I didn't even know how to begin translating that one.
That's the main story?
Yes. The mango-shaped breast is the top story.
These magazines thrive on celebrity gossip and sex. Most of their covers feature very young women wearing very little, and many have actual pornography inside. It'd be like mixing the sleaziest elements of the National Enquirer and Hustler with the cultural and political analysis of the New Yorker and the Atlantic. Like this article, which was next to the piece on the mango-shaped breast.
This is a good one. This is how the Prime Minister Aso's family business has been covering up defects in the high-speed roadways that they've been building. This is how they've been covering it up. And they've got internal documents, they've got photos. This is like the stuff you would hope that Japanese newspapers would do, but probably won't.
But magazine writer Yata Suzuki says the boring newspapers seem more credible, even when they aren't.
There are many who suspect the accuracy of what the weekly magazines write, even though in actuality the weekly magazines may have higher accuracy. There are many scandals where, although they are accurate, they end up being killed by the newspapers.
How do they kill them?
By deliberately ignoring them.
Meanwhile, the public is mostly unaware of the power of the Kisha Club. Again, Yata Suzuki.
I think that 90% of the average citizens don't know. However, 100% of the people in the media do know.
And since even magazine writers and freelancers depend on club members for juicy leaks, few openly protest the club system.
Ever since my start, I had serious doubts about the Kisha Club.
Ken Takeuchi started as a political reporter in the late 60s at the Asahi newspaper. In the 90s, he ran for mayor of Kamakura City and won. In 1996, he took the controversial step of opening up the Kisha Clubs in his jurisdiction to freelance writers and foreign correspondents.
Obviously, as mayor, it would probably be advantageous for me to maintain a cozy relationship with the press. But for the sake of Japanese media itself and the Japanese citizens, I thought, let the freelancers in. Let the foreign correspondents in.
Another governor followed suit by abolishing Kisha clubs altogether throughout his entire region. The Japanese Newspaper Association continued the trend by changing their guidelines. But since the rules for each club are set by its members, the guidelines are easily brushed aside. Former Mayor Ken Takeuchi.
You can see a couple of points of improvement, however, since the amended guidelines. For example, clubs started paying their own telephone and fax bills. Also, in the old days, government employees worked in the press clubs running various errands for reporters. Most of them are not doing that, after being told to stop.
After politics, Takeuchi has gone on to start a news website called Janjan, and he's hoping it can play a similar role as The Weekly by providing a place for unreported stories to get their first airing. Although it isn't his proudest scoop, Janjan was the first place to write about Prime Minister Aso's apparent inability to read kanji, the Chinese characters used in Japanese. By all accounts, kanji is difficult, but it's still an expected skill set for the prime minister.
We at Janjan were the first people to write about it. All the political reporters who are following the cabinet positions and are in charge of Prime Minister Aso would know that he is making a mistake in reading kanji. But they would not write about it, considering the relationship they have with him and the Liberal Democratic Party.
After it appeared on Janjan, they did start writing about it. Takeashi Usugi sees a similar trend now that video of legislative sessions is available on the internet. Bloggers are beginning to scrutinize and discuss bills that previously went unmentioned.
It is only the beginning, but the conventional political reporters' ways where they would cover up for their politicians are now falling apart, albeit little by little.
Strangely, the best hope for either opening or abolishing the Kisha clubs altogether may be the very thing we fear might ruin journalism in the U.S., a dying newspaper industry. Japan's colossal circulation figures have dropped in recent years, and a revenue crisis here could weaken the power of the Kisha clubs. That may be the biggest paradox, that the decline of newspapers could lead to a blossoming of real journalism, and Japanese newspapers might just find that printing a scoop once in a while is actually a great way to sell papers. In Tokyo for OTM, I'm Mark Phillips.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Mike Volo, Mark Phillips, Nazanin Rafsanjani, Michael Bernstein, and PJ Vogt, with more help from James Halver, Dan Mazzi, and Julia Simons, and edited by our senior producer, Katya Rogers. We had technical direction from Jennifer Munson and more engineering help from Zach Marsh. John Keefe is our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and find transcripts at onthemedia.org. You can also post comments there or email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from WNYC. Brooke Gladstone will be back next week. I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
On Notes from America, we have conversations with people across the country about how we can truly become the nation that we claim to be. Each week, we talk about race, our politics, education, relationships, usually all of them, because everything's connected. And you, our listeners, are at the center of those conversations. I'm Kai Wright. Join me on Notes from America, wherever you get your podcasts.